Ezekiel 38. In our last session, we noted that in Ezekiel 37, God, through the prophet Ezekiel, says, I'm going to regather Israel into the land. When she's regathered into the land, she is regathered in unbelief. And Ezekiel 38, the entire chapter, on through about half of chapter 39, deals with the fact that he makes a prophecy that Israel is going to be invaded from the north. And so we start with, who are the invaders? 38:1-6. And we begin with a leader, and then we'll move from the leader's land to the allies of the leader. And the word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, set your face toward Gog. And we'll simply list some of these words out. We know two things about Gog and what that word means. We know that it refers to a leader. It's not a place, it is a leader. We do not know whether it is a name or title. Gog can be a name or a title. So verse 2, Son of man, set your face toward the one who bears this title or the one who bears this name. He is of the land of Magog. And you say, I've never heard of a place called Magog. Well, if you remember, throughout history, different places have had different names. If I would talk about New Amsterdam, what am I talking about? I'm talking about New York. And one time, it was called by that name. And geographical cities and lands and nations have a historical record, and that historical record often reveals that they've had different names throughout their history. Gog refers to a leader. Magog refers to his land. And one of the ways of locating it is this. We know, in the first place, that Magog is a place far north of Israel. We know it is a land far north of Israel. We know that from two places, chapter 38, verse 15, chapter 39, and verse 2. 38:15. First, he's speaking to Gog, the leader, and Magog, the land. And in verse 15, he says, You will come from your place out of the remote parts of the north. So the emphasis is north, very north, remotely north. You and many peoples or allies with you, all of them riding on horses, a great assembly and a mighty army. Then you have 39 in verse 2. Where he addresses him again in verse 1 and says, I shall turn you around, drive you on, take you up from the remotest parts of the north, from the north, very north, and bring you against the mountains of Israel. So that we know this. When we look for Magog and the leader that invades Israel, we are told to go far north. Now, if you take the map that we passed out in the first session. And if you don't have a map, you do need one. So who's got the map or the maps? Okay, Jane. If you do not have a map, stick up your hand and Jane will come and shed light on you. We're dealing with a map and with places, and therefore you do need to have a map in your hands. Take your map and turn to this side of it that has down the right-hand side the 16 different places. And on the map, if you will go to the line that is drawn through it, and at the arrow point it says 3. And if you go over to the right, you notice 3 is the 36-degree meridian. And if you would take a globe, and I realize that on a map, the top is due north. As you know, the earth is round, and consequently you take something that's round and you squish it like that out into a flat map, the directions are slightly distorted. But if you take the 36 degree meridian, and that's that line number 3, and notice I've drawn it starting down at number 1. That's the opposite end of the, that's got the arrow on it. Number 1, and to the right of it, you've got the heavy black spot. The heavy black spot is Israel. The 36 degree meridian goes through Israel, and if you project it directly north, notice number 11 is Moscow. And notice that the line goes within less than 50 miles of Moscow. And then, of course, you go on up to the north, and you are with Russia and Moscow. You are in the remote parts of the north. So taking the identification out of the text that it's from the far north of Israel that the invader comes, you are coming right straight down from Moscow in the north. The historian Josephus, Jewish historian Josephus, identifies Magog with the people called the Scythians. S-C-Y-T-H-I-A-N-S. The Scythians, and we know about them, we know where they lived. We know that they lived in a mountainous area around the Black and Caspian Sea. And if you take your map once again, the Black Sea is number 4. Go to the line of the 36 degree meridian. The Caspian Sea is number 4. And the Black Sea is number 5. And so again, with Josephus, the historian's identification, you've got the people that live in that mountainous region right around the Black and the Caspian Sea, which is number 4 and number 5 on your map, or we are in the area which we call today the Soviet Union or Russia. Go back to Genesis 10, and in Genesis 10, you have a table of nations as to their origin. Verse 1 says, now these are the records of the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah. The sons were born to him after the flood. The sons of Japheth were Gomer and Magog. And so in the breakdown of the nations, or the origin of nations, and by the way, when you look at Genesis chapter 10 and you have various nations described, verse 3, the sons of Gomer, you have verse 4, the sons of Javan, and verse 6, the sons of Ham were Cush and Mizraim, Put and Canaan. All of those, there is not one nation mentioned in Genesis chapter 10 that cannot be identified historically today. In other words, we're able to trace back every one of these nations and define them. For example, Put, P-U-T, is Libya. And there's no debate on that. That's just a matter of historical fact that can be traced back to that. And so when God gives in Genesis 10 the origin of nations, in other words, where did the nations come from, the origin of nations are described under the Hamitic, the ones that descended from Ham, those that came from Japheth, and all these are listed in verse 1, and those that come from Shem. The ones that come from Shem are Shemitic. Or we don't say Shemitic, we say Semitic, S-E-M-I-T. Semitic nations, Israel, the Arab, and so forth. We're talking about Semitic peoples and their numerous Semitic language. Japheth was the origin of Magog. And we also know that something about Magog. We know that the son of Japheth was Magog, and we know that he settled in the or near the Caucasus Mountains, C-A-U-C-A-S-I-S. And if you go back once again to your map, and go down to number 9. We've identified the Caucasus Mountains. And if you go back to the line with the arrow on the end of it, and we've made little mountains in there under number 9, that's the Caucasus Mountains. And therefore, once again, the identification of this invading Magog is placed once again in the Caucasus Mountains, and you have an invasion from the north or from the area that is now covered by the Soviet Union. If we would set Josephus aside and go to Greek history, the Greeks called the people in this area also the Scythians. All right? This Gog, or this Soviet Union today, is headed by one who is the prince of three things. Gog is the prince of. And we're still back, and we're back now to Ezekiel 38. Son of man, verse 2. Son of man, set your face toward Gog, the leader of the land of Magog, which again, territory equivalent to the Soviet Union today. The prince of Rosh, Meshach, Tubal. Rosh, in the Greek history, was viewed as any nation or the nations of the far north. That, once again, geographically puts us in the area of the Soviet Union relative to Israel. Meshech, M-E-S-H-E-C-H, Meshech is identified with what now is Western or European Russia and is very probably equivalent to Moscow. Third, Tubal. Tubal is identified with what we would now call Eastern Russia. Russia is so big. We don't realize how big Russia is. In the Reader's Digest maps, Russia is broken down into three large maps. It's big. And when you go north of Israel, there is no way that you can find anything except Russia, 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 Russia. It's a Soviet Union all the way around the moment you go north of Israel. And the invasion predicted in Ezekiel 38 is from the north, and thus you cannot avoid the identification with Russia. Tubal, identified in history with Eastern Russia, is probably tied in with Tobolsk, T-O-B-O-L-S-K, modern name. Now notice that these northern powers are going to have a certain attitude and something is going to happen, described in verses 3 and 4. Verse 3. And notice verse 3 is going to focus on the attitude and the action of God toward this nation. It said, I want you to say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, and I will turn you about, put hooks into your jaws, will bring you out, and all your army, horses and horsemen, all of them splendidly attired, a great company with buckler and shield, all of them wielding swords. So notice in verses 3 and 4, you've got three things. Number one, in the A part of verse 3, God diverts this northern power from its original plan. He says, verse 4, the A part, I will turn you about. And the implication is what you intended to do, I'm going to stop. I will divert you from your plan. I will turn you about. And I will put hooks in your jaws, the idea of divine restraint. And third, I will bring you out, and they are brought out, as the context shows, against Israel. However, as that takes place, this northern power, which would be identified with the Soviet Union, has allies that join with her in this attack. And the allies are identified in verses 5 and 6. first, Persia. And as you well know, we do not talk about Persia today. We talk about Persia, which is Iran. And so Persia or Iran, it's been called Iran about 70 years. 75 years ago, you talked about Persia. From that point on, you're talking about Iran, which I've tried to find out, Iran, Iran, and nobody knows, I don't think. You listen to the newscast and everybody says it different, differently. But nonetheless, Persia is Iran, allied with the Soviet Union. If you look at a map, Iran would make an excellent ally of Russia. Let's see, what is it? Down on the map, it's number 14. Notice it butts right up against the Caspian Sea. And then to the left are the Caucasus Mountains. And therefore, Iran would be an excellent ally if Russia wished to come into Palestine. She'd have a nice land entry through Iran and would make an excellent ally. Second, you have Ethiopia. And if you go to the map once again, Ethiopia is number 6. You're going down to the south into Africa, North Africa. Ethiopia, allied with Russia. Ethiopia had about 3,000 years of absolutely stable government. Whether it was good or not is not the point, but it was stable until, do you recall your recent history, 1974. In 1974, Ethiopia went communist. And just shortly after she went communist, she attacked Somalia in Africa about 10 years ago and was victor over her. Next, you have Put. Put is the East European bloc, or it could be East Germany, it could be Turkey, but nonetheless, Libya identifies itself with... Put identifies itself with Libya. And we don't need to make much comment on Gaddafi. Absolutely a madman. So you have a pictured alliance of the Soviet Union, Iran, Ethiopia, moving down to Africa, and Put or Libya. And then next you have Tagorma. Tagorma is Armenia. We just recently had an enormous earthquake in southern Russia, or southern part of the Soviet Union, or Armenia, which again identifies with Soviet Russia. Now, when you see how carefully God has delineated the alliances of the Northern Confederation that attacks Israel, go to the flip side of your map. And notice with that you have the attack coming then from several directions. You've got your North African powers, Libya and Ethiopia, coming up into Israel. You have Iran. Then you have the leader of it, which is Eastern Europe or Russia, that goes all across the far north, comes in attack on Israel. Now, obviously, you would want to ask a question at this point, is the question, when does this occur? Ezekiel is prophesying it, but when? And there are two things that help to describe the when of it. Number one is the terminology used in Ezekiel. And number two will be the conditions that exist at that time. First, the terminology. The terminology is emphasized two places, 38 and verse 8 and 38 verse 16. First, 38:8, speaking to Gog, God says, after many days you will be summoned, in the latter years you will come into the land that is restored from the sword. So notice you have Israel in her land, And in the latter days of her history, you have the invasion. Verse 16, you will come against my people Israel like a cloud to cover the land. It will come about in the last days. So the term is twofold. You've got latter years and you've got last days. And that would show that Ezekiel is saying to those to whom he prophesied that relative to the fulfillment of this, you should not think of anything immediate. It is in the last days or the latter days, and the answer to, or the question that therefore comes out of this is they are latter days or last days relative to what? Remember, there are many terms that are pure relative terms. If a man is 55 years old and you're thinking of his age relative to baseball, he is old. If you think of his age relative to being the president of the United States, he is a young president. So whenever you talk about the last of anything, and especially in the Old Testament, latter years, latter days, relative to what? And the answer to that is if you look at it in all of its context, it is always relative to the return or the coming of the Messiah. That's its setting in the Old Testament. Therefore, Ezekiel is talking about something relative to the coming of the Messiah or the last days when this will occur. So we can define the time relative, we can define the term by those two expressions. We can also set the time by means of the conditions that exist. And the conditions may be even the most helpful part. And the conditions are defined in verse 8. After many days you will be summoned. In the latter years you will come into the land that is restored from the sword, whose inhabitants have been gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel. So the setting is the nation has been regathered into that place. You ever stop to think if they were reading these words in 1945, you would say, can't be. Because there wasn't any nation of Israel. Well, that's not true today. There is a nation of Israel, a very definable nation of Israel. And by the way, if you kind of stumble over, you mean the text says they're going to come in riding horses and horsemen, wielding swords? No way. We're modern. We don't fight that way anymore. I remember in 1969 in Israel, talking to a man who had been involved in the 1967 war, and he said, my grandmother went into war with us. And I said, what did she use as a weapon? What did she fight with? What did she do? He said, I can remember her leaving our home and leaving the kitchen with a broom to fight in the 1967 war. So it's not unlikely that these things could be. It's also very possible that Ezekiel is describing warfare in the terms that he would understand. The inspiration of Scripture simply says God takes the vocabulary of the author and expresses truth in his vocabulary. And therefore, to go forth with horses was the way they fought. That could be very easily referenced to include the weapons of modern warfare. But nonetheless, the attack is there. So, continuing in verse 8, or starting over with verse 8 because I rattled off in a direction. After many days you will be summoned. In the latter years you will come into the land that is restored from the sword, whose inhabitants have been gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which have been a continual waste, but its people were brought out from the nations. The nation has been regathered. Now please catch this. And they are living securely, all of them. Verse 9. You will go up, you will come like a storm, you will be like a cloud covering the land. Is there any reason why that couldn't describe an aerial attack? Very possibly could. Like a cloud covering the land. You and all your troops and many peoples with you, that is your allies. Thus says the Lord, it will come about on that day, the thoughts will come to your mind, and you will devise an evil plan. And you will say, I will go up against the land of unwalled villages. I will go against those who are at rest, that live securely, all of them living without walls and having no bars or gates. You have any idea what might move the northern powers against Israel? Any clue? I'll give you two of them immediately. Number one, the Dead Sea has the richest, hands down, richest mineral deposits in the world. That could be a magnet. Plus the fact that from all the nations of the earth, God has regathered the Jewish people into Israel. You know what the regathered Jewish people have in their pockets? Anyone make any kind of guess? A little bit of wealth. Money. And notice he points out that in verse 12, that's exactly what draws them into the land. To capture spoil, seize plunder, and so forth. And therefore, with an enormous concentration of wealth through regathered Jewish people into the land of Israel, you would have a magnet that would obviously draw them down and bring them into that land. So two things then define it in terms of the terminology, the last days before the return of Christ, the conditions, which would be a regathered secure Israel. Can you think of anything in biblical prophecy that might indicate why Israel would live in security? Israel, I've got a t-shirt at home. I should have worn it this morning. I love it. It says Israel, I-S-R-A-L, is, and then the second line, is R-E-A-L. Israel is real. And if there's any people on God's earth today that are realistic about their national existence, it's the nation of Israel. You get a little bit of thrill in your spine when you see a 15-year-old girl with her school books under one arm and her machine gun under the other, ready at any moment to go and defend. And they're realistic about the fact that there are Arab nations that would love to drown us in the Mediterranean Sea. And they're extremely realistic about life. You tour there and their ear is so to the ground. You'll be going one place, say on Tuesday morning, and you get up and prepare to go to that place. And they say, no, not today. Something's going to happen up there. And they have their ear to the ground. Of course, they've had 2,000 years of warfare there. And they're very, very much alert and very much ready. I'll never forget when we were going up toward northern Israel, and an Arab spit toward our bus, and we lost a bus driver. He parked the bus, bailed out, and he and Arab went sailing over the hill, and I think he probably settled an issue or two there, but they're realistic. The young people talked to a young man 18 years old who was on his farm the night before. He had flown a jet 500 feet over the Mediterranean Sea, dumped his load on Egypt, come back, went to work in the fields the next morning, and everybody sleepy-eyed woke up at the United Nations and said, what are we going to do about this? And it was all done. And that's one of the things you see about Israel, is that they don't wait for anybody to discuss their national security. They act immediately, and then they allow the United Nations to talk it over after the smoke is settled and everything's done, and it really doesn't make any difference what the United Nations says or does, or anybody else says or does. They're realistic about their about life. If you come across from Jordan, if you land in Amman, you down at the bottom of the ramp, there stands the Jordanians with their machine guns and filthy, smelly, dirty, raggedy uniforms. And you think, well, this is the Middle East soldier. Then you come across and you go down to Egypt, and you see their military people, and they're slovenly. Just everything about them shows a lack of discipline. And then you come up and you come across the Allenby Bridge into Israel. And all of a sudden, here are young men with polished shoes, with crisp uniforms, and all of a sudden, you know, these guys have got it together, and that's Israel. And so you'd wonder, well, how in the world could they come to a point where we gathered in that land without any security, with unwalled villages, without defense? Well, what happens at the beginning, according to Daniel, of the last 7 years of human history before the return of Christ? This great, potent, powerful leader in the Middle East makes a treaty with Israel for security. And apparently they have bought this, they have believed it, they're living in security, and suddenly out of that secure situation, the Soviet Union, the northern powers, look down and say, look at those mineral deposits. Look at the wealth in that land, and look at the fact that their borders are undefended. They have no walls around their cities. And they say this is a wonderful opportunity to come forth. And the divine perspective is God says, I'll put a hook in your mouth and drag you down into Israel and then destroy you on the mountains of Israel in such a way that the text says it will take 7 months to bury the dead of the Northern Federation, almost 86% of them totally wiped out by divine judgment on the part of the Lord. You come over to chapter 39. And I don't know what the means may be. Verse 6 says, I will send fire upon Magog. What might that fire be? I don't know what that fire might be. It could be a nuclear blast of some sort. That's a possibility. At any rate, we'll talk about the means as we get into it a little bit further. But the terminology and the conditions of Israel describe the time. Now, let's go to 38 and verse 7 through 9 and look at the invasion itself. Verse 7. Continuing to address the Northern Federation and its, or the Soviet Union and its allies, be prepared, prepare yourself, you and all your companies that are assembled about you, and be a guard for them. After many days you will be summoned. Notice all of this is under sovereign control. You will be summoned in the latter years. You will come into the land that is restored from the sword, have been gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel that have been continual waste, but its people were brought out from the nations, and they are living securely, all of them. And you will go up, verse 9. You will come like a storm. You will be like a cloud covering the land, you and all your troops, many people with you, that is your allies. And then you come down to verse 10 through 13, and you get what is it that draws them in from the human standpoint? What motivates them? The first thing we could say as terms of the motive is the motive comes from two levels. What moves these powers? Number one, you have a divine motive. And that is in 38:4, which we've already read. I will turn you about, and I will put hooks in your jaws, and will bring you out. In other words, there is a divine sovereign move. But in these verses, we look at the human. And the human motivation would come down to chapter 38 and verse 12. It says, you come down to capture spoil, to seize plunder, to turn your hand against the waste places, and so forth. When Israel gets regathered, one of the great features is going to be wealth. Keep your finger here and go to Isaiah 60. Isaiah 60. Isaiah 60. And Isaiah is talking about the people regathered into their land, and it describes the wealth that they possess. Chapter 60, verse 5. Speaking of these days, he says, then you will see and be radiant, your heart will thrill and rejoice, because the abundance of the sea will be turned to you. The wealth of the nations will come to you. And you can see how that would be. The scattered Jewish people regathered, and they bring with them into the land the wealth of the nations. Verse 6, a multitude of camels will cover you, the young camels of Midian and Ephah. All those from Sheba will come. They will bring gold and frankincense. They will bear good news of the praises of the Lord. The flocks of Kedar will be gathered to you, and so forth and so forth. And you have an emphasis on the enormous wealth that is brought into the land. And thus, saying that in Ezekiel 38, the northern powers move down into the land. And if you go back to chapter 38, verse 38 talks about when the attack takes place, chapter 38, verse 15, 13 rather, it talks about the response of other nations when this horrible attack occurs. It says Sheba and Dedan, both of which are Arab nations, and the merchants of Tarshish. There are two candidates for Tarshish. Tarshish was a place called Tartessus, and it was located two places, Spain and Sardinia. So the merchants of either Spain or Sardinia, with all its villages, will say to you, "Have you come to capture spoil?" And that all pictures a timid resistance to it all. "Have you assembled your company to seize plunder, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to capture great spoil?" And that attitude is one, again, of very passive resistance. Verses 14 through 16 reiterates the attack. Verse 14, "Therefore prophesy, son of man, say to Gog, thus says the Lord God, on that day when my people Israel are living securely, will you not know it? And you will come from your place out of the remote parts of the north, you and many people with you, all of them riding on horses, a great assembly and a mighty army." Now, when we talk about the attack is clear, but what about riding on horses? This can be taken one of two ways, and I'll simply present both. I do not know which one we want to go with, but we'll bet both options. One, you can take this as literal. It shouldn't be hard, and you say, well, I mean, we have advanced past that point. Well, may I remake again the point that we made this morning? The more man builds human technology, the closer he comes to being primitive. Because as you build technology, you build dependence. And when that technology disappears, you're a blithering idiot because you no longer have that thing on which to depend. And again, it's hard for us to recognize, being in a technological age, how dependent we are. Some of you that are in the computer business could probably give better illustration than I could. Unplug the computers in the world for 5 minutes, and you probably have global disaster. We are little potatoes, but would you believe, in getting out tapes and literature every week, that we are so dependent on a computer that we pay good money to guarantee that someone will be out here in 4 hours when the stupid thing breaks? And we're little potatoes, because the work simply cannot get done without the machines that do the work, and therefore you pay big money to do it. And we have one now, but for a period of a couple of years, you know what we didn't even have in this office? We didn't even own a typewriter. You don't use typewriters anymore. You use printers. And you get to the point where you come to absolute dependency on these things. We illustrated earlier. All of us would smile if you would, on a spring day, see a lady down at the creek with a washboard scrubbing clothes. Say, "What's wrong with you, lady? Why don't you get in the 20th century? I've got an electric washing machine." Well, have you ever stopped to think, if the electricity were gone, what would you do with your washing machine? I mean, really, for all practical purposes, you could throw some water and a couple of chickens in it and build a bonfire underneath it and make soup stock. Because that's all the thing is worth. It can't do anything it's intended to do. And so we come to the point that we are so dependent on these things. And is it conceivable that things could happen? The military has a concern that a atomic explosion could annihilate, because of its magnetic fields, annihilate data on all the computers. And again, the impact of that is absolutely colossal. So that the more man gets technological, the higher the possibility that something can pop, and all of a sudden we sophisticated people are suddenly back in the Stone Age again. I can serve as an excellent illustration. If suddenly you pulled out of my life the supermarket and I had to provide my own food. That's true. I can't even provide it out of a refrigerator. But the refrigerator's not there anymore, and Tyson is out of business, and you're going to have to go out and get something to eat today. I have some weapons at home. I'd grab a .22 and say, I'll shoot a rabbit. Problem is, I wouldn't know what to do with a dumb rabbit once I... How do you dehair the thing? I've never done that. I would not know what to do with a dead chicken. How do you get the feathers off of it? I do not know. I've never bothered myself with that because I've been surrounded with all kinds of conveniences. And probably if I'd say, well, I'll go out and I'm going to shoot a rabbit, pick up a .22 and load it, someone would say, sorry, you're primitive again. And the primitive man didn't have Winchester .22s. Give me the gun. Here's a rock. And so I would starve to death because most of my life would be spent completely reorganized. I really think that if we would lose our technology, we would not become primitive. We would become worse than primitive. We would be worse off without the technology than we were before it. So it is conceivable that this could be a literal invasion. By the way, who comes from Armenia, southern Russia? Has to do with horses. Well, no? Ever heard of the Cossacks? They come from Armenia, southern Russia. They could be taken as symbolic. In other words, Ezekiel describes warfare in the terminology of his day, in terms of his day. It's obvious that if you would talk to Ezekiel about an M16 or a helicopter or an airplane, he would have no idea what we're talking about. But he knew war. And he knew how they fought in those times. He knew what a sword was. He knew what a horse was and how they went into battle with horses. So it could be either way. And I do not know which one it is. I have no idea. The point is, it's an invasion. Whether it is literally riding up on horses, a possibility, or whether it is simply symbolic, Ezekiel describing it in terms of his own day, we do not know. We'll stop at that point, and in 17 we'll have the utter abolishing of the enemy. Yes? Apparently so. The final borders of Israel are described in the last part of Ezekiel, where you have the temple set up, the worship started, and the redefined borders. There's different opinion on that as to exactly. I think, and many do, that it goes all the way down into the northern part of Africa over to the Tigris-Euphrates. That's the way it's described in Genesis. So the land of Israel, as promised in the Old Testament, is much bigger than the Israel we know now. They're settling for much, much less and have given off a lot down in the northern region that is part of the promise. I think clear over the Tigris-Euphrates over into the northern part of Egypt. Alan? Gomer, and this is only a... I'm trying to say whether possibly or probably... I skipped that, didn't I? A probably or possibly Germany. Which would, again, it would fit with your East German communist bloc that would fit easily in with your other. Notice, by the way, the nation, the Soviet Union, and the Allied nations are all communist. So they have a basis for a unity. Not all of Germany is that, but they have a basis for a unity in communist doctrine. And you think of communist doctrine being, at its very heart, atheistic. That certainly shows light, or throws light on why God says, I'm against you. He's against them because of their anti-God attitude, and he moves to do this. It's very hard because we live in a day when the general attitude out there is, hey, wow, There's nobody at home in the universe. God's sleepy. He doesn't do anything. And he hasn't done anything. And the long-suffering of God is taken to be indolence on the part of God. And God is going to say in these chapters, I'm going to wake you up and my long-suffering will end and I will show that I am God. We will pick up next session with five purposes that God has in dealing as he does in Ezekiel chapter 38, 39. Father, we're thankful today for your word and your truth. May we understand it, recognizing that only a God of infinite knowledge can give us what the future events are. And we're thankful that we can be attuned to more than just the present. We can be attuned to the past and the present and the future through orientation to your word, for which we give you thanks in your name.